What up, Halloween peeps? Welcome to another episode of F This Movie, Like a Drug You Can't Quit. Joining me once again tonight, you know what, I never say my name at the beginning, do you realize that? My name's Patrick, by the way, I never say it, I just assume people know, people don't know who I am.
Everyone knows who you are.
My name is Patrick.
You're the world's lovable host.
And I am joined once again by horror movie expert, JB.
Hello. Hi. Tonight we're angry, but we'll get to that in a moment.
The horror movie month continues on F This Movie. This month simply will not end. And if you haven't done so already, please participate in the F This Movie, F Horror Movies Challenge. Log on to our website, fthismovie.blogspot.com, and find the F This Movie, F Horror Movies Challenge. Anytime you watch a horror movie in the month of October and your days are now numbered, log on and post a 7-word review. And as we've been doing, we're going to read some more of our favorite 7-word reviews that we've gotten thus far. Here's one.
You've only got 10 or 11 days left.
Yeah. And we're, I think, in the 60s. So the goal is to get over 100. Here's one from Pudatsa.
It's an unusual screen name.
It absolutely is. The Thing from 1982. All the horror, none of the women. Which is very good. Ciancio 23 says, Dawn of the Dead, 1978. 4 people, 1 mall, 1,000 zombies.
Which, I couldn't have put it better myself.
Yeah. Colleen says...
Oh, this is my favorite one.
Silence of the Lambs. It rubs the lotion on its skin.
And at this point, JB is disappointed because I was really hoping that Patrick would do.
Did you want me to do the voice?
He would do his Buffalo Bill.
I can't do that line. I can do. She a great big fat person. Just that one. That's the only one I can do. That's my Ted Levine.
And I was telling Patrick that a couple months ago, apropos of nothing, I was in the hallway of the school in northern Minnesota where I teach, and. A student yelled that down the hall.
It rubs the lotion on its skin.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
It was very disturbing.
Miguel Angel Sanchez, the artist behind the F This Movie fan art that you may have seen on our Facebook page, writes, The Last Exorcism. I saw this ending once on Scooby-Doo. Very nice.
And if it weren't for you meddlesome kids, I would have gotten away with it.
Tom says, The Wicker Man, 1973. Oh, Jesus Christ, they smoked the Equalizer.
And we love Tom because the number of cultural references running through that is astounding. By the way, for you fans of the Equalizer, the actor, Edward Woodward,
yeah.
Is in Hot Fuzz. He's the community watch guy who's always in the room with all the TV monitors.
Really?
That's the Equalizer.
Wow, I did not notice
and
that.
And Belloc from Raiders of the Lost Ark is in Hot Fuzz as the priest, and the James Bond is in Hot Fuzz as the grocery store interior entrepreneur.
If somebody wants to do one on the Nicolas Cage Wicker Man, just
don't.
Find a 7-word way of saying not the bees, not the bees.
In the words of Edgar Wright, don't. And I think there's one more.
And there's one more. Joey says, of humanoids from the deep, fish monsters rape women and kill rednecks. And if that doesn't make you want to see humanoids from the deep, I don't know what will.
I remember when that originally came out, there was some controversy about that.
The fish monsters raping the women?
Crossing a line
and killing the rednecks?
Some sort of hullabaloo about that film. Also, before I forget, there's a website that I'd like to recommend everyone. I'm guessing most people who listen to this podcast have already been there. It's called DVD Talk. DVD Talk. It's been around forever. And there's a columnist on that website. I don't know if he's on the website or he's linked to the website, called DVD Savant. And... You can get to this review through DVD Talk, and recently he posted his review of The Exorcist on Blu-ray. It is a must-read. It will turn your head around. Get it? But it's really, really good, and then people responded with emails, I suppose, and then he posted some of the responses. It is a must-read for this week.
As long as you're looking up DVD websites, also check in on DVD Verdict, where everything is worth reading. DVDverdict.com. And we should give out our email address because I forget to do that sometimes. fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com if you have feedback or shows that you'd like to hear in the future. Once November comes around, we will start reviewing normal movies again. Horror movie month will be over.
Patrick will read every word that you send us in an email, and then I will turn your email into a song.
Before we discuss tonight's pairing of films, which I think is an F This Movie first, I have to ask this question. Have you seen anything scary lately, JB?
I did, and we were talking about this before the podcast. Last night, Encore, I think it was Encore, showed Tremors in HD, and I love that movie. I love that movie so much. I can sum up the appeal of that movie in four words: Michael Gross, Reba McEntire. Just completely unique in the way it's executed, the way it takes what could be the tiredest of tired old drive-in fodder and makes it new and fresh and scary and funny. And who would have thought a movie about enormous worms under the ground who move incredibly fast could be one of my favorite movies, favorite horror movies, that is, of all time. And I guess it's coming out on Blu-ray, but not till after Halloween, which is a shame. But I got a taste of it in high def last night, and it looked beautiful.
I recently revisited High Tension. Did you ever see High Tension?
Yeah.
The first time I saw it, I did not particularly like it. And I think that's partially because it was sort of the first of a new wave of movies that are very obviously influenced by like 1970s, real kind of graphic, dark, survivalist horror, which Rob Zombie sort of specializes in. But High Tension was sort of on the early side of that, and I wasn't ready for it. And maybe because I saw it in a theater where it received a horrible English dubbing, it did not come out subtitled. I wasn't crazy about it. And rewatching it, I liked it a lot better, although I still have problems with some of the mean-spiritedness of it. And there's a twist in the film that I won't give away, but it is terrible.
The strain of movies that Patrick is talking about, and I'm well aware of them, all seem to be influenced by the Wes Craven Last House on the Left. Yeah. That seems to be a seminal work of inspiration for all these films. And to a lesser extent, I think the original Tobe Hooper Texas Chainsaw.
Definitely.
Those two films working together. So some films for your list. I think most people listening to this podcast have seen Tremors before.
Tremors is great.
On to the main attraction. And more grumbling. So if you like us are angry, stick around because...
I don't even know if I'm angry. I'm just confused. Tonight we're talking about two films. The Swedish vampire film from 2008. Let the Right One In.
I will not try to say the Swedish title.
Bjorn Fjorn, Right One In.
Let the Right Komen In.
And it's 2010 American remake, Let Me In, directed by Matt Reeves of Cloverfield fame.
Which is pretty much, and I was a big fan of Cloverfield, which is pretty much come and gone.
Yeah.
Because it was, it had the unfortunate bad fortune of opening the same weekend as Social Network.
Yeah.
And as a critic more savvy than I has pointed out, it seems to me The Social Network and Let Me In have the same audience. And they all decided to go see The Social Network.
See, I don't think Let Me In ever had an audience. I would argue that that movie was never going to make a lot of money. Most horror movies don't. There are a few that catch on and become phenomena, like the Saw movies or whatever, but... For the most part, most horror movies kind of come and go and maybe play to the horror audience, but rarely break outside of that.
It's just that's a very different reality in the early 21st century than I experienced when I was a young man. Because when I was a young man, anything that came out that was horror made a boatload of money and made a double boatload of money because they're cheaper to make than any other kind of film.
Right. So I don't even know really where to start because I'm guessing a lot of this conversation will be sort of philosophical in nature about, sort of remakes in general.
But may I suggest a thesis?
Please. I don't have one.
If you look at Let Me In, which is, I'm usually not at a loss for adjectives.
spicy.
It's it's a bad film, whether you've seen the original or not.
I don't know that I agree with that.
Well, my students certainly don't, because my students, the ones I spoke with who saw it opening weekend, liked it better than the original, which they had seen in my class.
I also don't agree with that. Chances are we're going to be spoiling parts of Let the Right One In or Let Me In. We'll do our best sort of not to, but to get into specifics in terms of comparing the two movies, if you haven't seen them, please see Let the Right One In, and then if you are so inclined, see Let Me In. Just be warned, Let the Right One In has subtitles, and that essentially, I think, is the whole purpose behind the American remake, no?
Which is odd, because when you put in the regular DVD and don't hit your remote menu button fast enough, it defaults to the English dub, which, interestingly enough, was the preferable way to watch it when the original DVD came out, because quite famously, the original DVD had the wrong subtitles. They didn't use the theatrical subtitles, which were very accurate and sort of colorful. They actually had a new set of subtitles done
by a person who couldn't speak Swedish,
which were very, for lack of a better word, crude. It did not correctly translate what was being said.
The main character's name in that version was Mr. Cat Poop.
And several websites made people aware of this. There was one website who had a screener that did have the theatrical subtitles, so that website was able to post frame grabs of the same scene with the good subtitles and the bad subtitles. The DVD company claimed that they weren't putting the shot on anyone. People were getting what was promised on the package, and so they wouldn't be replacing the original with the new one, which they then came out with, that had the theatrical subtitles. They played that game. It's an alternate version, but it's just as good. We're not going to do any... No give backs! You touched it last.
I have the Blu-ray, which came with the correct subtitles.
Right, and the subtitles do make a big difference. Oddly enough, the English dub is closer to the good subtitles than the simplistic subtitles. So that's a problem. Interestingly enough, when Matt Reeves was interviewed about his desire to remake the film, he said that he was a big fan of the book and that he wanted to go back to the book and sort of include more of the things that are in the book. Now, it's been several months since I've read the book, but my memory of the book is that Matt Reeves has not added anything from the book and, in fact, changed things and left things out that were in the book.
Had he just gone back and read the book and attempted to adapt that into a film, I'm not saying it would be a better movie, but it would sort of justify its own existence, because I think it could be different enough, or at least it's taking a different source material.
And the American version is different in a very specific way, and that's what I'd like to talk about, and that is my thesis.
Okay.
That if you examine,
we are going to be spoiling stuff then.
That if you examine the American version, you will see what is wrong with American movies right now.
Okay.
That it is an abject lesson. Sit down, watch the Swedish version to sort of have a baseline, and then watch the American version and note the differences, and note the extent to which Hollywood and American films hold their audience in contempt.
I would agree with that, but at the same time, I would argue that Let Me In gives the audience a lot more credit than the majority of American films, and especially American horror films.
In what way is Let Me In giving the audience credit for something?
I think it just requires patience, and I think it is more nuanced than particularly most horror films. Again, I guess I can only speak in terms of horror films. But
I think that's interesting, and I will give you this, that I remember Dana Stevens' review on Slate said that one of the few things that Matt Reeves kept from the original was the original's glacial pace.
Right.
And
it certainly spells things out in a way that the Swedish version does not.
And I would argue that it doesn't spell one specific thing out.
Yes.
That the Swedish version does, which turns the American film into a whole different animal.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
I am a big fan of the original Swedish version. It's an amazing film. A few months ago, there was an article in Video Watchdog, I don't know if it's available online, in which the critic compared Let the Right One In to Twilight and pointed out how similar the two tales were at the baseline. And that was a fascinating article. One of the things I like so much about the Swedish version was its pace, because in the early 21st century, with Michael Bay editing becoming so much more prevalent, I really give a film credit that's willing to slow down and take its time. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I have an endless attention span and want everything to be paced like a Michelangelo Antonioni film, for example, but I really give the original credit for having that slow, stately pace. And I will give you this, that compared to most American films, Let Me In, the American version, is slower. But again, I think the mind behind Let Me In is assuming that the audience is largely monkeys for the following reason.
Okay.
The book begins with a mysterious stranger moving into the housing project. The Swedish version begins with a mysterious stranger moving into a housing project. The American version begins with an ambulance, a police car, chasing another vehicle at top speed. And so Matt Reeves has told us, no, I don't have the patience to start at the beginning. I'm going to start in the middle, where it's a little bit more exciting, and there's a little bit more action, and a little bit more noise. So then, once we get one of the bigger, stranger reveals in the original, then we get the obnoxious subtitle, 3 weeks earlier. And then we go back. And this is very similar to modern biopics,
right,
that start with the person's either the highest moment of their career or their death,
right?
Bang!
Right.
I remember when he was a little child, and then we go back to their childhood.
The My starting God. In the middle didn't bother me, but the 3 weeks earlier really did, because, boy, we would have figured it out, if nothing else, when we arrived back at that point.
But I would argue, what is the thinking behind, it's very important to start with a car chase.
I agree with you.
That is a decision to start car chase. Another difference between the two that I questioned, and I love Elias Koteas.
Sure.
He appears in this film as a detective.
Right.
A character that appears in neither the Swedish version nor the book. And I puzzled over that, and it seemed so odd until I finally figured it out. In the spirit of Hollywood films about black people that always feel that they need a white character to guide us through the story of the black person, the most obvious example being the Hollywood version of the life of Stephen Biko, an inspirational South African character, if there ever was one. He was basically killed by the secret police and became a martyr to the civil rights cause. The American version, and I'm trying to remember the name of the film because it's not Biko, features a white priest character played by Kevin Kline.
I know exactly the movie you're talking about, and I cannot think of what that movie is called.
Maybe that's a good thing. We will not tell the title so you don't have to waste your time with it.
It's not Cry Freedom, is it?
It might be.
Okay.
We have Kevin Kline as a white American Catholic priest figure who I think was invented out of whole cloth. To guide us through.
It's the glory phenomenon.
The Ghosts of Mississippi,
yeah,
where the civil rights struggle, I don't know if that'll appeal to white people, so we have two white FBI agents to walk the white suburban characters through. Similarly, in Let Me In, we have this detective because the American filmmaker, Matt Reeves, said, I don't think people are going to be able to follow this unless they have a character in the film that's their surrogate. The detective is trying to figure this out, and so are we. Or was it crazy, batshit marketing minds who said, maybe we can make this more like CSI? Maybe. On the other hand, another reason might be that watching the Swedish version, they found it discomforting that there are all these crimes going on, and the people in the housing project are trying to figure out what's going on, but there's really no police presence of any appreciable kind in the Swedish film, which I would argue was an artistic decision on the part of the Swedes that works, and it's very subtle.
Yeah.
So it's as if someone's watching the Swedish version and going, where are the cops?
Maybe.
Well, we have the cops. Elias Koteas wearing a ridiculous mustache.
I do think that that changed. The only thing it affected for me was the last, his last scene in the movie where he, where she's in the bathtub, takes on a different tone for me in the American version than it does in the Swedish version.
Because now in that scene we have a different character.
Right.
Performing that.
And trying to achieve a different goal.
Yeah. Even my students picked up on this. Apparently the best way to scare audiences in 2010 is to subject them to a series of sudden loud noises.
Yeah.
And Let Me In might not be a better film than Let the Right One In, but it's a much louder film, which I kept being reminded of in the theater. Mainly because Let the Right One In, the original, is actually a very quiet, pensive film.
Well, and
with occasional moments of violence, but certainly not the volume of this.
Right, then those moments that you're talking about, the loud, particularly violent moments, unfortunately, I think are the most egregious mistakes that Let Me In makes.
And you're talking about
the CGI.
The minute... I'm sorry, I almost said Ellie. The minute Abby
yeah.
the vampire girl character, attacks, it becomes ludicrous.
Yeah, terrible. Like, not just bad because, like, oh, this is so much different than the Swedish version. It's bad in any movie. It's a special effect that you can't believe someone approved and put on screen in 2010.
It breaks the physics of gravity and turns the ravenous little girl vampire into sort of a weird, fast-moving, curious George.
Yeah. And to what end?
And I remember another example of that, one of the creepier moments of the original, which I really liked because it's in a lot of versions of Dracula, is Ellie, the female vampire in the original, can't get into the hospital through the usual way. And so they show her shimmying up the building
mm-hmm.
in a very interesting, studied, creepy way.
Mm-hmm.
In the American version, the special effect is left on the screen forever.
Yeah.
It's as if they're waiting for every boyfriend or girlfriend in the cinema to point.
Because it's sort of just in the background, and the shot is almost the exact same. I mean, the framing is
It's held similar. Forever.
Yes,
absolutely. So that every boyfriend and girlfriend right. can point to the right side of the screen and go, look, there she is. Very disturbing. I thought it was interesting that in this version, Oscar, who is now called Owen, is given a pair of binoculars with which to spy on his neighbors,
mm-hmm.
two of which become victims of the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So we get this weird Rear Window like homage for a very short period of time, mm-hmm. and I wondered, to what end? What does that add to it? That's a question. I don't know the answer.
You know, I don't really think anything, and I don't like the way that that whole victim subplot is handled in the American version, and we'll get into that in a little bit because that involves some spoilers. But, you know, I think what they emphasize a lot more in the American version over the Swedish version is loneliness, that the main character is driven by loneliness. And so to me, that opening scene with the binoculars is just him trying to be a part of other people's lives because he doesn't get that anywhere else.
Yes.
The Swedish version, he's more of like a sociopath.
Yes, very definitely.
Right.
From the very beginning.
Right, and he's not in the American one.
Why don't we just spill it right now?
Mm-hmm.
We're at the halfway point.
Spoilers, everybody. If you haven't seen it already, please see Let the Right One In.
My biggest objection to Let Me In is that it takes something that it's in its original version is saying something very dark and very disturbing and very profound about relationships. The relationships that we forge, what we get out of them, and what we give up to be in them. Ellie is a vampire. And as in many other films, we learn that the vampire needs some sort of keeper that is the vampire's willing thrall and basically becomes the slave to the vampire and is basically their lookout during the day. And in most of these tales, the keeper's life does not end well because ultimately the keeper winds up being another victim.
Mm-hmm.
In the Swedish version, her keeper, and this is made maddeningly ambiguous in the Swedish version, which is another thing I like. But from reading the book, in the Swedish version, Ellie's original caretaker is a pedophile who, through fault of his own, becomes her slave. And this is actually presented in both versions. I really like the fact that the original caretaker is really bad at what he does.
Right.
Although
so is Richard Jenkins.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. In both versions, that's our way in as the audience.
Right.
It is not easy to kill a person and drain the victim of the blood. In the American version, we none too subtly find out that the Ellie character, Abby, has had this caretaker in her thrall since he was approximately Owen's age. We see a photo strip from a carnival or something on a table, and we ascertain, A, this has been going on for a long time, and B, Owen is about to enter into the same relationship.
Right.
The biggest problem is, in the Swedish version, the Ellie vampire character keeps insisting, I'm not a girl. And in the film's most disturbing shot, every time I show it in class, my students cannot deal with everything that shot suggests.
Mm-hmm.
The shot strongly suggests, and the book supports the fact, that Ellie is not a girl. She is a boy who has been castrated. And that throws her entire relationship with Oscar into a very disturbing... This isn't a romance in any shape of the any way, shape, or form. That there's homosexual undertones, it turns it into an entire alternative lifestyle WTF nightmare.
But wasn't it already? I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying, but wasn't it, even if we're calling it a quote unquote romance, there's nothing conventionally romantic about it.
Well, I would argue with that.
Okay.
Clearly, at the beginning of the film, Oscar is seeing it very much in terms of a romance, in terms of explaining to her what it means to go out.
Sure.
In terms of her disrobing and getting into the bed. There are conventional aspects of a teen romance, twisted though they may be, that completely go out the window.
Okay.
When Oscar is watching her dress and sees something she shouldn't see. He shouldn't see. See, I'm already getting confused about gender.
We just keep saying he.
In the American version, Abby keeps insisting that she's not a girl. But clearly the audience is instructed to believe that that means, I'm not a girl, I'm a vampire.
Right.
And the film makes very certain of this by doing two things. Number one, and I predicted this to my students. I told them weeks before the film came out, that disturbing shot will not be in the American version. You will not be seeing that. That is too transgressive for an American film. And guess what? I was right. But even worse, the film places this gloss of sickening romance over the proceedings by having the Owen character studying Romeo and Juliet, turning this into a doomed romance where the young people want to get together, but societal forces keep them apart. And to Matt Reeves' credit, he finds a line in Romeo and Juliet that seems to have something to do with vampires. But if you've read enough Shakespeare, there's something in Shakespeare to talk about anything. I must go and live or stay and die.
Yeah.
It's when Romeo's leaving Juliet. He makes use of that line. And
but doesn't she write him in that? Doesn't she write that in the note in the original version too? Doesn't she leave him a note in the original?
But it doesn't say that.
It doesn't?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
You've seen it more times than I have. I'm now confusing the two. I would argue that the casting of Chloe Moretz, who is fine in the movie, automatically, I think, undoes any possibility that she was once a boy. That the girl playing Ellie in Let the Right One In is far more androgynous looking and when that reveal comes, you say, oh, okay, maybe, but there's no way looking at Chloe Moretz that you could say that she was ever a boy.
And I'm a fan of Chloe Moretz, but I actually think in this one she's given very little to do.
Both of them are, sort of.
Except be sad and sort of depressed and then have this sort of blood frenzy where they change her voice electronically to no end. Other objections to the American version are, I think they keep bringing things up only to do nothing with them.
Okay.
It's established that Owen's mother is very religious. Mm. In fact, when they show him stealing money out of her purse, there is a, it's not enormous, but it's certainly large in the frame. There's this picture of Jesus on the mirror. Maybe the picture isn't that big. Maybe this is just my Catholic guilt coming out. But it's established that the mother is very, very religious. To what end? What is done with that thematically? It's also presented that she's an alcoholic, something right. that's not in the original version. Right. And again,
I guess just to establish this home life where he's home with her, but very much alone,
which is horrible. And then he makes the call to his father, and the, right. and the father is no help.
I thought it was interesting that the mother was never really in the shot. I mean, it's a little on the nose, but
it's right. interesting. They either that's show a way to her. Do it. They either show her from the waist down, or she is in the background and right. she's out of focus. Right. And for a couple minutes, I thought that was interesting. And then on the way home, my lovely wife made a joke that she kept expecting the mother's voice to be a trombone, like in the yeah, Charlie right. Brown cartoons. Well,
where you there's don't moments see the where I think, like, oh, they're kind of going for this world without adults, but that doesn't really hold water because we have the detective, we have Richard Jenkins, and we have the gym teacher.
Speaking of Richard Jenkins, and we were talking about this with some people in line for The Massacre last week, and if anyone knows something about horror films, it's people who go to The Massacre. I will give the American remake one thing, one little thing.
The car scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one.
Yeah.
That's one of the most amazing things I've seen.
There's in a car accident that's filmed from the inside of a car, seemingly all in one take, where the car does crazy things. And it's an incredible shot, and it's a great, the whole scene is great. And it makes you wish that there were more places where the film, the American film, diverged from the Swedish film, because, you know, maybe it would have something to offer. Because yeah. Otherwise it's in these little ways that you're talking about, but they change a lot of things. Aside from just the Romeo and Juliet, I noticed different places where Matt Reeves is trying to sort of shoehorn in subtext, and the Ronald Reagan stuff running throughout the movie.
Which is another thing I wanted to bring up in terms of it. The film takes place during the 80s, and it's very grounded in the 80s. So in the hospital, we see Ronald Reagan on TV, and he's going on and on about something. But again, like the mother's religion and alcoholism, I don't understand.
Well, he's speaking about evil in the world.
The Reagan 80s bred right. vampires. This was the beginning of our national nightmare. I'd like to think that I'm an intelligent person. I don't understand what it adds up to. And while we're on the subject of 80s, I am not a fan of the film's heavy-handed 80s references. That the minute, snot-nosed young filmmakers say we're in the 80s, we can sort of slather on these touches like Blue Oyster Cult song "I'm Burning for You."
A lot of music
in a film whose arguably most famous scene is a woman bursting into flames in right. a hospital room. It just seems a little bit too easy. At one point, the mother's watching TV, and she sees something that was very popular in the 80s. Trust me, folks, I was there. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? But, oh, I get it. If one of the kids is a vampire, that makes that funny. It's heavy-handed. It doesn't add up to anything. It's annoying.
A lot of musical cues, which, you know, a lot of movies do when they're set in a period. It's, well, let's play a lot of songs from that era, and then you'll know that you're in the 80s. And I didn't care for a lot of that. Although some of the reviews I've read keep calling out Michael Giacchino's score as being too bombastic and heavy-handed, but I actually really liked the score. I think maybe there was too much of it used. Like, the movie's almost wall-to-wall score.
Yeah.
But I actually liked sections of the score a lot and found it effective.
And I'm going to argue that the score was effective, because I'm of the opinion that if you remember the score, they're doing something wrong. Oh. I want a movie score to disappear. If okay. it calls too much attention to itself, I don't think it's doing its job.
Interesting.
At least that's what I think.
Yeah.
Although, oftentimes in movies, I will find that something in the film is making me cry, and only later realize that I think it was actually the score.
Okay.
That it's and you know that the score sort of helps oh, sure. you along. To some sort of
the end of Inception. I went and saw Inception a couple times, chasing the feeling that I get at the end, which is 75% the score.
Mm-hmm.
The way the score swells at the end, that's the feeling that I kept going back to that movie for, was just to hear that score in that moment. But back to Let Me In.
And this is a quibble. One of the things Matt Reeves brings to the party is that in the American remake, the Oscar/Owen character steals money from his mother, which he didn't do in the Swedish version, and he seems to be spending it all on candy. So we have this sort of half-baked attempt to show us that Owen's weakness is for candy, and it's something else that is... Am I pushing maybe, this interpretation?
Maybe.
That it's this forbidden thing that you're not supposed to have too much of, and he's clearly committing one sin to buy the candy, and that it's something that goes in your mouth, and it's something that's eaten. And to give Reeves credit, he uses a real candy that was popular in the 80s called Now and Later. And in fact, this dovetails nicely because in both versions there's a scene where the boy tries to get the vampire girl to eat some candy. And in both versions we learn that vampires can't eat anything normal because it makes them incredibly sick. So, way to go on that. At the end of the American version, we get the exact same scene as the end of the Swedish version. Let's just say they're together on a train. And in the American version, very prominently in the background, we see this candy, these candy boxes and these candy wrappers. And I'm sitting there in the theater, and I'm about to give the film credit, and I'm thinking, that's really good. That's fairly subtle. Now and Later. Because that candy had a little song associated with it, a little jingle that they used to play on the TV commercials. And throughout the film, Owen sings it. And it's eat some now, save some for later. And at the end, when we're on the train, I'm looking at the candy, and maybe this is just me, I'm slow on the uptake, I'm looking at the candy, and the double meaning of that sinks in, and I'm like, that's really clever. And at that point, they have Owen sing the damn song again. Yeah. Because there might be a couple people in the theater who didn't get it. Because you're chimps. She's a vampire, and they're in love. And that's all you need to know. One of my students described it as Twilight for little kids. They described Let Me In as Twilight for little kids.
Interesting. See, I guess I would never say that they're in love. They obviously...
But doesn't the film bend over backwards?
This one does, certainly more so than the other one, because, yeah, even you pointing out the Romeo and Juliet stuff, I mean, definitely. But I can't, you know... I wouldn't call what either one is getting out of that relationship love, necessarily. Not of the romantic kind.
And that's what makes it so fascinating.
Right.
Because suddenly we're able to look at relationships in an objective way. It's sort of what Roger Ebert said about David Cronenberg's Crash. That what Cronenberg has done, and of course J.G. Ballard, who wrote the book, is find an objective correlative to sex that is so completely unlike sex, that is so completely unsexy, that it gets us to examine sex in a completely objective way.
Mm-hmm.
The minute we establish that Ellie is a boy, that relationship becomes something very different, and much more disturbing and much more intriguing in my eyes. And
maybe I just have misread the movie for years, or I don't know, but whether she's a boy or whether she's a girl, I feel like both parties are getting the same thing out of that relationship.
Oh, definitely.
Right.
And
so I guess it doesn't make all that much difference to me. And maybe I'm just bringing that same thought to Let Me In, and maybe Let Me In doesn't deserve that. You know what I mean?
The nasty irony at the end of Let the Right One In is that I think Oscar's better off at the end. And once the film takes us to that place... That's a place that movies don't take us to very often.
Right.
I think one other thing that Matt Reeves brings to the party, and again, I'm trying to be fair and objective because, as you know, I really like horror films. I like the fact that in the American version, the bully is clearly shown to be bullied by his brother.
Right.
Much more explicitly than in the Swedish version.
Yeah.
And I like that. And I actually gave the film credit in much the same way that I give the original Swedish version credit for having ambiguity and shades of meaning, that this American film would actually try to engender some sympathy for the bully. Because in the Swedish version, during the climactic massacre in the pool, there's one child who was not very big on the bullying, who's off to one corner crying, and he's left alone. In fact, during the bullying, he's saying, oh, I think that's enough, and he shunned. In the American remake, it's the bully who starts to say to his brother, that's enough. And I thought that was a real nice, subtle touch that we don't often get in American films.
There's a big difference between the two that I observed, and then in doing some reading, I will apologize because this isn't my observation. This belongs to Devin Faraci, who has been brought up on the podcast before. Formerly of Chud, now sort of freelance, about to announce some sort of his own venture, but he's no longer with Chud. But he sort of articulated something that was bothering me, and so I apologize for, I'm not stealing his words, this belongs to Devin Faraci. While I'm not crazy about the whole subplot in Let the Right One In with the friends who drink, and that they are sort of, you had talked about them earlier, and that's, some of those scenes don't work. The scene with the cats, I don't love the scene with the cats.
Oddly enough, if I could just interject.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like the scenes with the drinking buddies.
Okay.
I think it's showing us where Oscar's going.
Okay.
And where his father is getting to, because in the original version, his father is clearly an alcoholic.
Right, right.
The cat CGI stuff
yeah.
bothered the hell out of me.
Yeah.
The first time I saw the film.
Yeah.
The more you see the film,
yeah.
the less it will bother you.
Okay.
It's really it's very small pieces yeah. of film.
Matt Reeves sort of jettisons that whole thing, but also gets rid of all the drinking buddies, again, in favor of this police officer. So in the original version, it's the girlfriend of one of these drinking guys who is attacked and begins to notice changes and has to make a choice. Major spoilers, I apologize. I can't talk about this without really giving it away. She realizes what's happening to her, that she is becoming a vampire, basically, and she's hospitalized at one point and makes the decision to sort of immolate herself, and she has the doctor, orderly, open the curtains so that she's bathed in sunlight and bursts into flame, essentially committing suicide. In the American version, it's the woman that Owen is spying on that is attacked, and she really has no place in the story, and she is hospitalized, and her death is an accident. Somebody opens the curtains and doesn't know, and it's very reminiscent of that scene with Don Rickles in Innocent Blood. That's what I was thinking of the whole time. It's done much better in Innocent Blood. And she, of course, has to take a nurse out with her because yeah. the American version just has to be a little edgier, or not edgier, but just more violent, basically.
More gratuitously cruel.
So Faraci's observation is that doesn't work, that what's great about that scene in the original is that we are presented with the alternative, that while we sympathize with Ellie, here, you know, as a character, essentially she's killing people to stay alive, that it's this selfish thing that she does, and here we're presented with an alternative. Here's somebody faced with the same fate who chooses to die herself rather than become what Ellie is. And that's an interesting counterpoint, and the American version does away with that, that we never get the other side of it. We never see someone who is a vampire, who may become a vampire, who chooses to die rather than murder people for centuries to stay alive.
Because like Twilight and True Blood, Let Me In romanticizes vampires mm-hmm. and sees it as a kind of wish fulfillment. One of the more disturbing things I found about the original, and this is also in the remake, is Ellie's advice to Oscar about being bullied.
Mm-hmm.
Hit him. Hit him harder than you dare. And I'm sitting there as an adult and a teacher and a father, thinking, is that the best advice against bullies? And oddly enough, in both versions of the film, clearly it is. Because it works in both cases, at least for a while. It gets rid of the bully for a little while. In both versions, and in True Blood, and in Twilight, the vampire is presented as this superhero who can help you
mm-hmm.
because they have all these magical powers.
Right.
And again, that's a key scene because what you're doing is horrible. It's sinful and disgusting and against all codes of conduct and illegal and anything else you want to do. You're killing innocent people. And yeah, the Swedish version does present an alternative. Rather than romanticizing it. Ellie does have another choice.
Right. I don't know, you know, I mean, there was all this brouhaha when it was announced that Matt Reeves was going to be remaking Let the Right One In because it is a movie that is beloved, especially in the horror community, and everyone's feeling was, well, why? What is the point? What is the purpose? All he can do is screw it up, basically. And I don't know if I'm being an apologist. I didn't hate the movie. I just don't understand its existence. It's similar. And you've brought up a lot of points, you know, where it diverges and where it's a lesser film or a more heavy-handed or obvious film. And you're really right on all of those. But as I was watching it, it felt almost like the Gus Van Sant Psycho, where it's so similar sort of in tone and scene for scene, beat for beat, story-wise.
That the reason it was made is that American audiences will not watch subtitles.
Right. And that's or crazy.
That the American audience will not watch black and white. But it also seems to be a film without an audience. Because, as right. many reviews pointed out, why did they remake this? Even the Swedish version, which was beloved, made less than $10 million in this country.
Right.
The people who love the original are either not going to go to this or they're going to disdain it. And everything that you loved about the original, and clearly Matt Reeves loves the original, will doom it to failure at the box office here as an American film. It's literally a film without an audience.
Right. That you're really only making it for people that saw the other one, and why do they need this version? They have the other one. They love that. Why, you know, especially if you're not going to bring anything new to it. And I am certainly tired of the glut of remakes, particularly horror movie remakes, that it seems like every 2 out of 3 horror movies that comes out now is a remake. I'm very tired of it, but there certainly can be good ones, you know, where it's more like a cover version of a song you really like, where they bring something new to it, you know. The Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead is not Dawn of the Dead in any way. It took a movie that was great and made it a movie about nothing, but it's a great movie about nothing, you know? It's exciting and violent and scary, and it's a lot of fun, but it lacks all of the substance of Dawn of the Dead, but that's okay. They're very, very different, and I don't necessarily know how he could have made a movie that was very, very different, but as I sat and watched it, I did not dislike it as much as you, and I thought, well, if Let the Right One In never existed, if I had never seen it, I might think this was pretty good. But to what extent, you know, can you call a guy who changes every 25th word of Hamlet Shakespeare? You know?
It left me feeling sad. Sad for the state of our civilization. And also wondering why every 20 years or so do vampires reemerge?
Mm.
What is that in our consciousness mm-hmm. that needs that? About every 20 years. We have the Universal Cycle, and then we have the Hammer Cycle 20 years later. In the 70s, we get the Frank Langella version and the reimagining on Broadway. And then in the 90s...
Oh, we had the 80s. Lost Boys, Near Dark, Fright Night, sort of all around the same time.
And Kim Newman has this feeling that in the 80s, it was a socially acceptable metaphor for AIDS, sexually transmitted disease through the blood. But clearly...
Kim Newman also has a funny mustache.
Yes. I've actually met Kim Newman.
Oh, yeah?
And I felt I already knew him because he's in a fantastic documentary called Fear in the Dark, where he comments on things. But he's also the DVD critic for Video Watchdog and does really? Amazing work in that magazine. Kim Newman's great, but I wonder, vampires are so much part of popular culture in this decade. What is it? In my class, we've argued that it's teenagers' ambiguity about new sexual freedom, that teenagers are feeling pressured to be sexualized for a number of reasons. Teenage girls feel very ambivalent about the way they're supposed to act or the way they're not supposed to act. So I've always thought that Twilight is popular because it imagines a different lover who's not interested in you sexually. Who's interested in you for more romantic things, which is interesting because that's what a lot of gothic romances center around, you know, the perfect dark boyfriend. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I'd be interested in talking to people about it, but why the influx of vampires and why did I have to sit through Let Me In?
I really did not dislike it as much as you. I just felt like it was pointless. It took... everything that was good about the original and either approximated it or did it to a lesser extent.
Yes.
That's what most remakes do, honestly. But this one, I guess, had more potential and did a lot of things, again, I think, well and better than we typically get in an American horror movie. I know they took away the subplot about the, you know, possible castration, but even though it's underscored a little bit too much and they don't make him a pedophile, even the scene where it becomes very obvious that Richard Jenkins is in love with this child mm-hmm. is not something you typically get in an American movie.
Then in both films, Ellie, Abby, placates the adult caregiver by putting her hand on the side of his face.
Right.
And it's a very, very disturbing image of an adult and a child. If I was a snot-nosed, smart-ass film critic, I would conclude by saying, let me in, let me out of the theater!
Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget about the F Horror Movies Challenge. And for myself and JB, eat some now. Save some for later.
Nah, 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 nah.